Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Almost every day we see or read reports of devastating events with the potential to cause immense human drama. Yet most of us have a limited and limiting understanding of trauma. We believe it only surfaces in instances of death, chronic illness, or the major cataclysmic life events in the news. But as psychiatrist Mark Epstein reveals in The Trauma of Everyday Life, trauma isn't a rare event. Even the everyday sufferings of loneliness and fear that we all experience are traumatic. As Epstein explains, trauma is not only central to our psychology, it helps define us as human beings. Here he examines the transformational potential of trauma and uncovers how it can be used for the mind's own development. It's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Epstein to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
So as we look at this anniversary of 9/11 and say that is a traumatic event, you write in the book that trauma has so many different facets, and I guess it all comes down to how we label it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, we're used to talking about trauma as like the big trauma where you confront an actual or threatened death or serious injury and then have feelings of fear, helplessness, and horror. And we like to think that that only happens to a few people, you know, in other parts of the world or sometimes in downtown Manhattan, you know, like at 9/11. But I think trauma is really a spectrum and that we're all getting glimpses of it in our everyday life, you know, sometimes just with as our parents age or as things happen to our children or as we try to cope with our relationships or our job security or whatever it might be. But that trauma is really something that everyone has to face on a regular basis and that we can learn from the people who have big trauma. We can learn about the defense mechanisms that we all use and try to be a little more real about it.
You make a distinction about moving past it to rising above it.
Yeah. I like to say that if we're not suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, then we're suffering from pre-traumatic stress because the sense of impermanence is really with us all the time. And we think that we have to soldier on, you know, there's a kind of rush to normal. We have to get past it. But I think we can learn to acknowledge that that's actually the way things are. And when we do that, we can relate to each other a little more kindly.
In other words, we have to accept it. Instead of trying to avoid it, we have to allow it to become a part of our existence.
Well, it's hard to accept. You know, I've been influenced a lot by the psychological teachings of Buddhism. And the first noble truth of the Buddha, a lot of people think he said life is suffering, but he really just said one word, which was dukkha. And dukkha, it actually translates as difficult to face or hard to face. He was saying that there are aspects even of normal life that are hard to face, but that we do better when we acknowledge those. Sometimes they're hard to accept. I don't think we can just jump into acceptance. But if we acknowledge that there are aspects to life, even a good life, that are hard to face, then we can be a little more real.
An understanding that suffering is universal, and it is without logic.
It's universal, it's without logic. It doesn't mean that you did something bad in your past life or when you were a child. You know, we have the natural tendency to try to take responsibility for what happens to us. A friend of mine was in a car accident a couple of weeks ago where the person behind him had a heart attack and the car banged into them, and he and his wife were all right, but he said a good thing, I thought, which is that if he had done something to cause the accident, he might have felt a little better about it in some way. The fact that it was entirely random, you know, and just struck him out of the blue, that kind of thing actually happens more often than we think in life, and we just have to learn how to roll with it.
How does that kind of thinking, do you think, make us more resilient?
Well, you see it in children a lot, you know, when the parents are having trouble, when the parents get divorced and so on, the children naturally want to take responsibility for everything. And when you're always taking responsibility for all the bad things that are going on, it makes you brittle. So when you can actually be in the world with the chaotic underpinnings, you know, it makes us a little more flexible. And that flexibility is a helpful thing because difficult things happen that we can't control. You know, we try to control most things, and we do a pretty good job up to a point, but things happen that we can't control. So there's a kind of flexibility that arises in the ego as a result of this kind of thing.
Expand on that a little bit of how our pain ultimately connects us to the world.
Well, there's a statement by a poet once that the human brain works slowly, first the blow, hours afterward the bruise. You know, a lot of times we don't know what we're feeling. It goes straight into us, and then we only later can begin to make sense out of what's happened, out of what we felt at the time of some kind of difficult event. And that process of making sense of ourselves is what connects us deeply to our humanity. It lets us peek more deeply into our psyches, you know, the way those of us who practice psychotherapy know that everyone's sitting on something, you know. And it comes up through our senses and out through our dreams.
You write about this in the book, but was it always for you a marriage of the scientific and the spiritual?
Well, I had the unusual experience of being drawn to Buddhist psychology, Buddhist philosophy, when I was still in college, before deciding to go to medical school and become a psychiatrist and become a psychotherapist. So I always listened to what I learned from my Western teachers with a kind of third ear for whether it was consistent with or not consistent with what I had already absorbed from the Buddhist world. And I found that much more often than not, it was entirely consistent. So I became interested over the course of my career in writing about the confluence of Buddhism and Western psychotherapy, Western psychiatry, and now Western neuroscience even, and how in different languages these two very divergent traditions are actually saying very similar things.
So for patients coming to you, there is a difference, obviously, between treatment and prevention, and I assume you're doing both, and you're using both philosophies.
Yeah, well, I try to the extent that they've merged into one kind of understanding that's helped me with my life, I don't try to directly push the Buddhist thing or anything, but I just try to be helpful to whoever comes. A lot of people are dealing with grief and mourning, around parents or loved ones or relationships. And one of the things that's infiltrated our culture is what was once a very helpful contribution by the Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who talked about the five stages of grief. And she said they were denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance. And people now believe that that's a formula for grief, and they should be able to move through those five stages and get over it, get on with it, within a certain limited period of time. And I think that's one thing I've really been able to help people with, is to understand that grief or mourning is really different, really idiosyncratic, really different for each person. And there need be no timetable, there need be no formula. That you can just sort of learn to get out of the way and allow the feelings to do what they need to do, and you'll be better off for it.
Just looking at the title of the book, The Trauma of Everyday Life,
mm-hmm.
even though we will get beaten down in a day, it seems as though we enter the day hoping for the best, that it's going to be a good day.
Yeah. That was a famous statement of John Cage, you know, every day is a good day. He was very influenced by Buddhism, but he also uh, tried in his music and in his writing to not push away the unpleasant and not cling to the pleasant. And that's a kind of condensed version of what the Buddha taught. It's a miracle every day. Every day is a miracle that we're alive, that we are capable of love, you know, that we exist. But the preciousness of each day is more acute when we understand how impermanent everything really is.
And by the same token, you don't want to wake up and say, well, today's going to suck because yesterday did.
No, that even the Buddha would not say that. But that's the right approach. He said there's suffering in life, but if we have to suffer, we might as well suffer wisely.
And suffering wisely is something that takes time, right? I mean, you talk about the teachings of the Buddha, but this is something that comes through time and through practice.
It comes through practice, yeah. Some people get it immediately, and they can really turn their perspective around in a moment. And some people have to practice diligently, even religiously, in order to reach that kind of understanding. But I've been really helped. Some of my Buddhist teachers often say it's not what's happening to you that matters, it's how you relate to it. It's how you relate to it that matters. And that's a kind of very clear teaching. We can't really control everything. The thing that we can control a little bit is how we meet it, how we relate to it. And there's a natural tendency to push away the unpleasant, to turn away from what I'm saying is or could be traumatic. But if we train ourselves to stay with it a little bit longer, we find that we can tolerate more than we think. And that opens up a kind of sympathy, a kind of kindness that we can learn to deploy both to our own experience and to each other. And we all really need that.
You do write in the book about the freedom that can ultimately come with going through that trauma.
Yeah, well, the Buddha taught a concept of emptiness, which is always misunderstood, but another translation for emptiness could actually be freedom. The word that he used to describe emptiness derives in the Sanskrit derives from the word for a pregnant womb. So emptiness is like the womb that holds everything. It reveals that we're not all alone in our cage of self-conceit the way we often believe we are, but that actually we're all part of some more interconnected web.
So how does
that's a kind of freeing realization.
How so? How is that freeing? Because it's a responsibility as well.
It's a responsibility, but the best treatment for trauma is really to give to others. You know, because the thing about trauma is that it feels singular. You feel like you're the only one that this has happened to. There's a famous story in the Buddhist literature about a young mother whose baby dies, and she's distraught and, you know, starting to really scare everyone in the village and asking for a doctor to bring her baby back to life, and everyone's scared of her, and finally someone sends her to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, oh yeah, I have medicine for this problem, but first would you just bring me a mustard seed from the house of someone who has not known death? And she goes off to the village, and she can't find anyone who has not had some experience of death. And in talking to the villagers and in relating to other people about their suffering, she begins to see this thing that the Buddha tells her, that the thing about this world is that everything is impermanent. And she becomes able even to use the most horrible thing of the death of her child to illuminate her own mind.
The name of the book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. It is published by the Penguin Press. Mark Epstein, a pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much.
Very nice.
See you again, I hope.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. It is published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.